Accession number 18362, Reel 2.
Rondo Avin, Reel 2. You were telling me about the men who became Buddha.
Okay, yeah. Now, from this camp, we moved to another, where we were given the job of carrying a lot of palm trunks, palm trees, you know, carrying those around and so on. That lasted about a month, and we were shifted from various camp, you know, to different camp here and a camp there. And then disease hit us, and we had dysentery. I had 3 attacks of dysentery. We had to keep a record for the Japanese how many times a night we'd gone, because you're passing all this mucus, you know, from your backside. And I remember once, you know, 42 times I went. 2 colleagues of mine died from it, but I got over it, and you know, several others got over it. And that was rather a cursed camp, because everything bad happened. We had this one particularly horrific experience, I mean, watching another man's plight, that is. We used to have to queue up to wash our... I used a car hub as a plate. You know, I had an old car hub, which I used. And you had to queue up and dip your plate in this boiling water to sterilise it. You know, they pretended they were concerned with our health. They weren't really, unless they were, because we were slaves. But anyway, one night we were queuing up to wash out, and I heard these dreadful screams. And one poor devil, he bent over this, it was a big iron cauldron of boiling water, and he slipped, and he went right in it. Head, shoulders, arms, oh God. Unfortunately, he slept right opposite me in this shack where we were. And the doctors tried so, our own English doctors tried so desperately hard to save him. They made an incision in his throat and put a tube down, you know, for him to breathe. And he was, but he died, you know, and he died in great agony, which was very distressing. And then a great day came when we had to have this vast parade. The whole length of a road was lined up with prisoners of war, because one of the great Japanese generals was coming round. And he gave us a lecture. He stood in the back of his car, and there were sort of microphones put up. Prisoners of war, you are now prisoners, and you will not go, you will not return to your country, you will become citizens of Japan. But you must work hard, and you will become strong and intelligent and healthy like the Japanese people. You know, listen. And then a few days later, we paraded again. And then counting men, stop, they marched off, stop, they marched off, and then stop. They apparently went to the dreaded Burma Railway. We didn't know at the time. And then several of us, then they said, right, you men, march the docks. So we had to march down to the docks in Singapore. And we were put aboard a rusty, reminds me of Masefield's poem, Dirty British Coaster with the Salt Cake Smokestack. This dirty, rusty old boat. And we marched on, and then weeks of hell started, Mr. Wood there. We were herded down into the hold. They allowed us approximately 12 to 14 inches space per man. The ship was rat-ridden. I was amazed at the size of their tails as they ran along the girders. Cockroaches, everything. They put us down there, and some others in an after-hold there. I think there were probably about 1,000 men crammed into that boat. Few Japanese guards, and off we went. We had a long, long voyage of several weeks. The ship anchored off Saigon, and we passed by the coast of Formosa, and it was a nightmare. And all the time, being herded down. There was a ladder leading up to the combing of the hatch. You took it in turns. And they fixed up some troughs to pee in and a place to shit in. And so all day long, when I look back, you sat up there and you'd say, you looked down into the hole and you said, two for a shit, one for a piss, two, all day and all night. And that's how it went on. They lower down this awful cauldron of absolute crap. So it gets awful. And, of course, the bloke's got sick, so you stick in your helmet and you wait till you could get up and sing it over the side. And then the Japs thought they would give us some work to do to occupy us. And it was an iron-decked old British coaster. And we used to have to go up and chip, 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 chip. It was lovely to get up in the fresh air, but awful if you were below, because you had this bang, bang all the time. And that's how the journey there. There was always a fear of submarine attacks, and eventually we got there, creeping along, because, a convoy, as you well know, so you can only go as fast as the slowest ship. And it was an old, slow ship. And we never had a wash. We had nothing. We must have been stinking the whole thing there. And then we ran into a bloody typhoon. I've seen it on films. I never realised how awe-inspiring and how awful it could be. The skies was as black. In midday, suddenly the sky became black, and the sea that was running was incredible. This old ship we were on, it was rolling and creaking and groaning and all the time, and blokes were being sick, and it was a nightmare. But we got through it once again. We got through it. And then the great day came. Ten men at a time on deck. And it's just before we landed, and we landed. No, before we landed, they fixed up this great canvas thing of seawater on the deck. And we had to jump into this thing and rub ourselves down, with seawater and all the rest of it. And could be dry on nothing but the bloody bits of old bloody shirts we were working. So we did that and we got dressed. And then we landed. Don't ask me where. I cannot remember in Japan where we landed. I just can't remember. Kyoto, was it? I don't know. It may have been Kyoto. I can't remember. But anyway, then they decided they would humiliate us in front of the public. And do you know what they did, Mr. Wood? I'll tell you. We had to lower our trousers, bend over, expose our arses, and they gave us a dysentery test. They put a glass tube up our backsides, and they said, I'm taking a smear and putting it in a little tin with your name on it and your thing. And they did that, and the public were looking and laughing and God knows what. And then they marched us to the station, and I ended up in, it's spelled Aomi, A-O-M-I, but often it is printed in books as Omi. The Japanese do pronounce it as Omi. When we arrived there, we thought, oh, look, great. There was this quite well-constructed camp, a ground floor and a first floor full of, not bunks, but you wouldn't drink them. And they gave us a good meal. We thought, this is not too bad. Great big cauldron came out with a lot of vegetables floating in it, bit of rice. But of course, the next day it was quite different, because all we got then was a cupful, no bigger than that, a scoop. They called it soup. It was just green water with a few leaves in it. And that's what we lived on for the final 2 years in Japan. We lived on 3 cups a day, and the Japanese were very, very short of rice, and they used barley, which they used to cook, or some of our own boys had to work in the cookhouse, and they made dough balls. They used to cook the barley into a pulp and then squeeze them into a ball like a doughnut. So you had one of those and a cup of that 3 times a day. And you had to work on that often from 6 in the morning till sometimes 7 and 8 at night. Now.
So this is a POW camp at Iommi.
Iommi, yes. The carriage from here, shall I just, and now we were given different jobs. If oh, my wife's taking it away, but on the cover of that Sinkor relic of the prisoners of war, you know, in Iommi prison camp, it's got on there the jobs. There was the quarry job, the factory job, various other jobs, and we all sort of took turns in doing weeks on the quarry, or weeks in the furnace, weeks down at the coal stuff, you know, and there were several jobs as you were switched around. And that was pretty hellish. Because, if you worked on the quarry, you had to be very careful because you never always warned people when the thing was going up. And you just, a couple of blokes had their legs blown off up there through 40 blasts and stuff there. And then there was the factory where I did that job. You wore what they called, if I remember right, a hayako. It was like two wooden uprights which were strapped to your back with a box attached to it, and they would load these boxes up with shale or for whatever they were going to use. Sometimes it was coal, it depended where you were dumping it. And you were given, in the winter, you were given, you know, the straw circular hats the Japanese and Chinese wear, your straw hat and straw cover, you know, I forget what they call those two. You have those drenched with wet, and you'd carry these heavy boxes. When I think about legs, which were like, I wonder how we did it, but we did it, and we crammed up, and I had one terrible job stacking bricks, and they put a plank and filled these boxes with bricks, and you know how heavy they are, and we used to walk up this plank in pouring rain, all weathers. Someone would tip it, oh, like that. Bricks would fall out, someone would stack them. But of course, the pile got higher and higher and higher. Two stories, more. And of course, the plank got steeper and steeper and steeper and the wall. I don't know, you know, I can see the men now slipping down there and slipping. I did myself once or twice. And that was another job, an awful job. And all the jobs are awful. And there was no mercy. And I was on one of these jobs one day with a thing on my back, and I had a terrific, like an ulcer, on the back of my neck. And carrying this stuff, it burst. So when I got down to the bottom, I showed the Japanese guard, and he roughly took me to the guard room and looked at it. So they always remember they had some black adhesive tape. So one of the Japanese soldiers just cut a chunk off, slammed it on, and left it. Do you know, it healed with that filthy bit of bloody adhesive tape. I kept it on for days and days, because you never had a doctor in this particular part of the camp, for days and days. And one day, you know, I said to one of the boys, would you peel this off? And he did. And he said, you know, Ron, he said, it's quite healed. It's got together. And that was that. And then I had one of the worst times of my life, Mr. Wood, there, was we were working, what do you call that, little narrow gauge, you see them in coal mines, don't you, with the little trucks they wheel along.
Yes.
They laid these because they wanted some stones shifted across the field. They were going to lay a small track. And they wanted a track made through, there was a large embankment, the high embankment, and the train used to run across. They wanted I suppose it was half again as wide as this room, and they wanted us to, two of us, to dig a tunnel through so that we could wheel the tracks through. So, a big job, but they only put two of us on it. I was a pickaxe, and a friend of mine was with a shovel. And while we were working, on occasions a train would pass overhead, and I said to him, I said, we've got to be very careful here because this is going to go in. And we got about 6 or 7 feet in, and it happened just as I was picking. Well, I knew no more until I suddenly came round. I remember some fellows dragged me out. They dug me out, took all the earth away, dug me out, And I came round, you know, quite suddenly, and I said, okay, because I went to stand, and that's and I'd broken my leg. I didn't know it, of course, at the time. Beneath this knee, which has given my made my knee with arthritis that size, under there. So now, do you know, Mr. Wood? They carried me down to a rotten, broken old shack, planks missing from the siding, and they put me on a table with a damp old piece of blanket over me, and I was lying on that table with a broken leg from, what, this time, I remember, yes, it was nearly lunchtime, mishy time, as they called it, and they left me on that thing until 6 o'clock at night. And they made a sort of temporary stretcher, and they carried me back to the factory hospital used for the factory workers. But it wasn't a hospital, it was like a large building. And in it, there was an American sergeant, always remember him, Sergeant Merriman, and Joe Mann, another American. Merriman had his leg blown off at the quarry. Joe Mann had a chunk of his foot blown off. And there was myself with a broken leg. Then they took me into another room, and the Japanese doctor was there. A very, very nice man. Spoke superb English. And he called me soldier. He said, put him down here to that. So he said, soldier, he said, I'm very limited to anaesthetics, which I must keep for the Japanese soldier, for the Japanese workers. He said, so I'm sorry, but I've got to set your leg without any anaesthetic. He said, it's going to be very, very painful. So he got two of my own fellows, boys, holding me down here. And then he got a Japanese soldier. He instructed him how to pull my leg down. And he was watching, he was aligning it to my knee. But up, like that. And he put a long strip of metal behind my leg. And they bound it up, round and round and round and round, until it was done. Carried me back to this room, where the two Americans were, on some lice-ridden straw. And that was a period then of, what, maybe 3 weeks in there, I remember. 3 weeks, yes. And believe it or not, three men, one leg missing, one with a foot missing, myself with a broken leg, and had a bloody guard sitting on an upturned bucket watching us. And he hated it because he was scratching because the lice and the bugs were terrible. He hated it, and so on and so. Once again, a little bit of humour crept into this situation. Joe Mann, this terrible, naughty American, every now and again a nurse would come in, and she did actually look at the dressings on these Americans' legs. But Joe would say, Tuesday, she's coming in, and Joe would pretend he was asleep, and he would lie there like this and pull his shirt up so he was fully exposed. And I can remember this young Japanese nurse, oh, and the guard would say, put it out, and then Joe would, sorry, and he'd pull it down again. He did it all the time.
She was covering her eyes up.
Oh, yeah, all the time. And then the time came when they told me that I was going back to camp. So there's some fellows came in, the boy from camp, carried me out, and they put me on a huge sledge. I said, we'll be taking you back to camp if there's some heavy snow. And they were lugging me along on this thing, and I thought, well, where the hell is the bloody village where the Aomi? And apparently, this time of the year, they had so much snow there that the Japanese were almost virtually living under the snow, underground. They dug roads down and things like that. So they got me back to camp, and because I couldn't work still. And one of the boys bought, the Japanese gave one of the blokes a couple of big sticks of bamboo, and they made me some crutches, you know, split the bamboo down, bound it round, put a crossbar here, which were very, very good, to help me a lot. And I had to potter around, and then they thought, well, we can't let a prisoner of war not do work. So they took me up in a truck with two other prisoners who were slightly wounded, and they put us in a shed, freezing cold, and you know what they made us do? They had three or four large sacks of rusty nuts and bolts, and we had to sit all day long in this bloody cold freezing shed, rubbing rust off these bloody things, you know, with like emery paper. It was painful, painful. Now, let's go back. In the meantime, some engineers had taken from Singapore a radio, disassembled, and they sealed it up in Fray Bentos corned beef tins, and they managed to smuggle them all the way through Singapore camp, right over here, and they assembled them. Now, we had a Lieutenant Burrows, lovely man, an Oxford blue, very proud of his rowing shirt. Lieutenant Burrows, Lieutenant Lee, oh, I think it was, I can't remember the other one, Abbott, something like Abbott, I don't know. Anyway, they were in a, you know, the officers, as far as Japanese concerned, they were as useless as prisoners were anywhere where prisoners were. So, but they had a little loft place just above where we slept. And they assembled the radio and used to tune in at night, and they used to pick up the America. And now, as well as having a night guard, Japanese night guard patrolling, we also had to provide our own picket to make sure the camp was safe, because in the winter they gave us this ridiculously small charcoal fire to dry our clothes, you know, a joke. And so we had this, when the officer, the nights, not every night, but on the nights he was tuning in, we had to make sure that we were visible to him in the loft through a crack. Now, if we saw a guard approaching, we would either sort of rub our ear. One, we had different signals. One night we'd rub our ear, you know. Another night we'd pick our nose. Another night scratch our head, you know. Any some little action, we used to work it out. And so we knew how the war was going. And it was a dangerous game to play. But that went on throughout the 2 years. The Japanese never ever discovered it until at the end of the war, when Lieutenant Burrows carried it down into the compound and put it on the table. And the Japanese saw it then and looked at it blankly and never said a word, not one word. And so he said, one down, when I come down without my moustache, he said, you'll know the war is over. He said, because they have recently dropped a massive bomb. That's all he knew about it, you know, at Hiroshima, I suppose, Nagasaki. And so the following day, I went up on another job. My leg was a lot better by this time, of course, so I was working up in the sort of forestry department up on the mountainside where they used to cut trees and some drag them down. And then about midday, it was all men back to camp. So we guessed, you see, and we arrived back at camp. The Japanese commandant, who was a severe but just man, you know, he's not like the first two we had, who would bash you if you even looked at them, you know. He said, English soldiers, the war is over. Your people will be collecting you in the very near future. Now, if you take my advice, and the last word he ever spoke to us, if you take my advice, keep in the camp, because the Japanese people are in a very strange state of mind. So he said, please keep in the camp for your own safety, which we did. And then a couple of days after that, all the guards went. They left their rifles. They left everything. The guards, the officer went. We were entirely alone. Then a couple of days afterwards, we spotted a plane. From the camp, we looked right through in the valley, through the mountains, and we saw this plane coming down in the valley, and he circled the camp several times, and he started waggling his wings. And the officer said, he wants to drop something, clear inside. So we went inside, and he did. He dropped his great leather bag, and Rita's got a copy of it there. You read it, the Dutch in all languages. You know, yes, you know, we would be dropping so and so. 2 days later, three huge B-29 bombers came over, and the bomb bay doors opened, and down came these great barrels of food. Unfortunately, a couple fell on the village. I think a few Japanese were killed by those. Some, a bit bad aiming actually, some fell on the mountainside, some near the camp. Fortunately, none fell on the camp. And then we all went out, and we, got to open them, got as many as we could. And we had, being Americans, they dropped enough food for 3,000 men, let alone a few hundred. And we were loaded with food, and on the paper it said, do not overeat, and all the rest of it. Some did, and were seriously sick and ill afterwards. And stayed there. From then on, we stayed there. Now, having told you these dreadful stories, Mr. Wood, about the brutalities, and, can I go back a year?
Sorry.
I remember when we were first taken prisoners, we had to go to the hospital every day, and we used to have to take all the blood-stained sheets full of pus and vomit, and we used to take them down to the beach, and we used to strip down and flap them up and down in the water, and beat them in the water and slash and slash and slash, day in and day out doing this, and then fold them up. Then they would lay them out to dry in the hospital. And it was rather a harrowing job, that. And during the day, you would hear further along the beach, the rifles going off, people being executed further up the beach. And each time, you could see it in your mind.
In Japan?
Pardon?
In Japan?
No, this is going... I've gone back now to Singapore.
You've gone back to Singapore?
Yes, the hospital in Singapore. As I forgot all about that, talking to visit in Singapore. And you heard all these bangs and bangs and bangs. And, of course, we were allowed the time, while we were working in the hospital, to go and visit any of our colleagues that had been wounded and sick in there. We were allowed a few minutes just to go and say hello to them. And... that was a rather a nasty thing. And that brings back another nasty memory, Mr. Wood. I remember a friend of mine, Lofty somebody, I can't even remember his name, but Lofty. I'm getting very forgetful as I get older. And he died. I've seen men die with dysentery, which he did, but he was about the thinnest of the lot. He was a bone, virtually a bone, when he died. And yet he was still trying to smile. And I can remember we had a sort of temporary burial plot. And as he was a friend of mine, I volunteered to help push his body down on this wobbly old trolley made of a couple of bicycle wheels, And I can always remember Mr. Wood wheeling him down. And I remember his feet poking out from the blanket which we covered him with, and they were sort of rubbing my hands. And for a moment, I thought, man, must be a knife, But of course, vigor mortis had passed off and his body was a bit soft. And it was horrible. It was rather, it was very sad. Very, very sad indeed.
Was that in Singapore as well?
This was all in Singapore, from the hospital, and they were dying there. And now, from there, can I go back to Japan?
Yes.
I go back to Japan to finish off with.